Hello. On the front cover of the American woman's magazine, Ms., there's an image of Barack Obama. Tight across Mr. President's chest is a provocative T-shirt with the slogan, "This is what a feminist looks like." The first bill Obama chose to sign as the leader of the free world was the Lilly Ledbetter Act, promoting equal pay for women and for men.
Lilly Ledbetter did not set out to be a trailblazer or a household name, come with speaking up for what she deserved. But instead, she decided that there was a principle at stake, something worth fighting for.
He's being hailed as a feminist president. But what does the F word mean today? The term feminist actually comes from France. During the French Revolution, women's rights were part of the citizens' quest for equality. There was a feminism in Paris in the 1880s, and the word feminist was first listed in the Oxford English Dictionary in 1895. In this first programme of three, we've gathered together key women active in the 60s and 70s in America and Britain, what Martha Lear, writing in the New York Times in 1968, dubbed the second wave of feminism. The activist and historian Sally Alexander, lawyer and US campaigner Sonia Pressman Fuentes, academic and writer Elaine Showalter, and journalist Anne Leslie. And Leslie, at this time, you are one of the highest paid writers in Fleet Street, and yet you were refused a mortgage in your own name. I imagine that you look after equality, but do you call yourself a feminist?
The trouble is with the definitions of feminist. There's one definition, which is the one I lived by, is nobody is going to pay me less than a man if I'm as good as, and often better than him. But the problem with the label feminist, it became so caught up with the ideological idea of feminism, which was anti-male, almost as its base, which was taken up by the people who wanted a separate female state, which Betty Friedan, who was very important, because in 1963 she wrote this book, The Feminine Mystique, said to me, you know, this is so denying human nature, biology, everything else. It was completely loony. And that's why I never called myself a feminist. In the first definition, I was.
The UK seems to me to typically have fought very shy of the label feminism. Yeah. If you think about it, Mary Wollstonecraft, back in the 18th century, wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. Queen Victoria despised the mad, wicked folly of women's rights, and the suffragette Christabel Pankhurst declared the rights of women are not only to be free, but to fight for freedom. But in the United States, the banner of feminism seemed to find a warmer welcome. Joining us on the line from Florida is Sonia Pressman Fuentes, who in 1966, along with Betty Friedan, was one of the founders of the National Organization for Women, NOW. Sonia, how would you define a feminist?
Well, the term is a lot simpler for me. A feminist is simply a person, man or woman, who believes in equal rights for women.
Is it true that you wrote down the mission of NOW, not even on the back of an envelope, but on the back of a paper napkin?
That is correct. Betty Friedan did write the purpose of NOW on the back of a napkin. And when we were founding NOW, we had quite a discussion on whether the organization should be named the National Organization of Women or the National Organization for Women. Fortunately, the side that wanted four women won. We wanted to make it clear to men that they were welcome in the organization. We had men as founders and we have men as members.
And Elaine Showalter, I'd like to bring you in here. I know that you're trapped inside in a snowy Washington. Can you hear us?
Yes, indeed. I would really make a distinction between feminism and a women's movement. There's no pope of feminism. There's no leader who decides who belongs, who doesn't belong, what are the terms of membership. If people want to call themselves feminists, that's fine. There is nobody, no admissions committee. It's existed for a long time before there was a term for it, and I think it will continue forever. But a woman's movement occurs when there is some overriding set of wrongs and injustices and inequality in a society that people feel can be changed. That's very important. And I joined NOW the day that it opened in New Jersey. It was something I had been waiting for my whole life. So I was a feminist looking for a movement.
But while Betty Friedan was alive, I think we did have a Pope, and she was it.
Now, let's just listen to Betty Friedan putting the sexual into politics.
To wear a bra or not to wear a bra is hardly the most essential question of this movement. But this is neither a bedroom war nor a fashion war. This is, in the biggest sense, a new kind of politics. What happens in the bedroom will be affected by it. The kind of orgasms women are able, and men too, to have will be affected by it. The action is to change society, to restructure society. That I am free to wear a bra, not to wear a bra, is my business and yours, you know. But it's the media that want to dismiss this as a joke.
Bras, or more importantly, the lack of them and bra burning, became somehow symbolic of 20th century feminism. But in fact, what's interesting is no bras were actually burned. In 1968, outside the Atlantic City Convention Hall, tokens of oppression, girdles and Playboy magazines and mops and some bras, were just dumped into a bin. But because there was no permit for fire, not a single match was struck. And yet society wants to remember that there was a conflagration. Sally Alexander, you're now a professor in modern history at Goldsmiths College. You're used to sifting fact from fiction. Do you know who started the rumour that bras were burned?
No, I don't. I'm sure it was the media. And it was a story that was told over and over again, and women did take off their bras. I mean, that is what we did in the Women's Liberation Movement, as it was called. It wasn't, there was a resistance to describing ourselves in Britain anyway and in Europe as feminist for a very long time, partly because we looked back at the previous stages of the women's movement, at the suffrage movement, and before that, even to feminists like Mary Wollstonecraft, as being for individual women's rights. And feminism didn't seem appropriate for the kind of liberation that we wanted. There was masses about changing your clothes and ripping off your bras and taking off your girdles and wearing no more suspender belts. And women talked a lot in consciousness-raising groups and in activist groups about how they should appear and what they should wear. And Shulamith Firestone wrote an extraordinary book published in the early 70s, which was all about how you had to change your persona as a woman, and not just the way you looked, but also the way you smiled and talked to men and appeared in public. And, you know, because women's bodies were spectacles for patriarchal society and for men's consumption, this was the kind of way we thought about it, and you had to change the ways that women were seen.
What about the problem, though, with bra burning being an urban myth? Because it did create a very negative perception of what the feminist movement was about.
Oh, negative. Oh. Why was that negative? Because of the burning or because of getting rid of the bras?
People today still say, oh, I hope you're not a bra-burning feminist.
They do, but they most often say, they hope you're not a man-hating whatever. And indeed, you know, we've all had our moments of hating men, I'm sure, but, you know, man-hating is not part of what the women's liberation movement was ever about.
One of the most liberating things I found in the 60s, when the second wave of feminism arose, I didn't need it in the sense that I was paid terribly well, I was quite famous even then. I suddenly thought, I don't have to wear bras that look like sort of bomb casings. I don't have to strap myself into Playtex. Do you remember those awful rubber things, which, you know, in hot weather, you smelt like melting tarmac, and to try and get them off, there were all these awful, and that was just me, not just some chap who was trying to get them off. There was these awful sort of slapping sounds, and I suddenly thought, I don't care. I'm not gorgeous in that sense. I don't really care. And actually, I know it's, you know, people say it's trivial to pick up on the women's liberation movement influence on clothing, but actually clothing has always, to a certain extent through history, as you, Sally, know, a way of corralling women. You find it, because I work a lot in the Middle East, the chador, the abaya, the niqab. Clothing is actually more than just fashion. It actually expresses something about society. And I love the fact that when I tore off my Playtex girdle, never will I wear this again.
This is something that the second wave feminists took up with great gusto. Let's remind ourselves of a few landmark events.
1960.
Suramavo Bandranaike in Ceylon is the first woman in the world to become prime minister.
Birth control pills approved for sale in the USA.
1963.
US Equal Pay Act. Betty Friedan publishes The Feminine Mystique.
1965.
Equal Employment Opportunity Commission formed in the US.
Barbara Castle becomes Secretary of State.
One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
1966.
National Organization for Women founded.
Indira Gandhi becomes Prime Minister of India.
1967.
Abortion Act passed.
1968.
Women machinists at Fords of Dagenham go on strike for equal pay.
New York radical women protest at the Miss America pageant.
Got my eyes, got my nose, got my mouth, I got my smile.
1970.
500 women meet at Ruskin College for the first conference of the Women's Liberation Movement. Equal Pay Act passed in the UK. Protesters flower bomb Miss World contest at the Albert Hall.
Sally, you took part. How media savvy were you? Did you realise that the television cameras were there and therefore what you were doing would be broadcast to a truly mass audience?
Well, as a set of kind of women, young women, we were very frightened, alarmed by the media and very wary of the media and convinced we would never be portrayed sympathetically. But with the Miss World demonstration, the aim was to make it a media spectacle. I think I would take issue with what Elaine said. I think that it wasn't a movement with leaders in London or in Britain. It was a movement which had very diverse kind of origins, and the organisation of the demonstration against Miss World was absolutely typical of the organisation of most campaigns in the women's liberation movement. It was groups of women from all over the country, you know, the kind of message spread through word of mouth and I suppose telephone calls and so on. We all had to dress up to go into the Albert Hall. We were searched. There was a lot of security. And the signal was a football rattle. And Bob Hope was the compere. And we were going to wait until the very end of the proceedings. And the rattle was going to come just when the girls were parading off the stage. But in fact, Bob Hope made us all so angry, or certainly the woman with the rattle very angry, when he talked about Vietnam and having just come back from Vietnam, and this was the height of the anti-Vietnam campaign, that the rattle went off early. So we all leapt up, throwing flower bombs and little plastic mice and tiny things we had in our handbags, and we threw them onto the stage and leapt up and demonstrated and brought it to a close, actually.
Isn't it wonderful how history is full of not just conspiracies but cock-ups? I mean, that was bad. I love it.
Yes. How did the authorities react to your flare bombing?
Well, some of us were arrested. I mean, the place was packed with policemen. It was, in fact, a very volatile moment in British politics. And there had been a bomb scare outside which we knew nothing about. And our slogan was, and our leaflet was, "We're not beautiful, we're not ugly, we're angry." You talked about the significance of slogans. Well, that was the one we were throwing around. And the assumption was that we were involved with the anarchist group, the Angry Brigade. So we were arrested, some of us, and taken away, and I was taken away, and we were locked up and for a few hours and questioned and then let out on bail eventually after some hours.
You'd actually led quite a quiet life up until that point.
Yes.
And suddenly you're in prison overnight.
I tell you, it wasn't a quiet life compared to the life I lead now, Bethany. But yes, I was deeply shocked. But it was 1970. There had been 5 or 6 years of radical politics in London and Britain, indeed throughout the world. I mean, the women's liberation movement came out of the civil rights movement in the States, but also out of the New Left, and were familiar with coming up against, you know, mounted policemen or something. But it was a terrible shock.
And Sonia, do you think the kind of demonstration that we're talking about, something which is very loud and shouty, is that good policy?
Well, it has its place. They were very effective in the suffrage movement. Alice Paul used demonstrations against Woodrow Wilson that were very effective in getting us the right to vote in the United States. so they certainly do have their place, and government officials pay attention to large numbers.
But some of these do seem rather ridiculous acts, and something that you write about in your book are speculum parties.
Oh,
what on earth were those?
I have one of my loopier phonist friends invited me to what she called a speculum party. I said, what's that? And she said, oh, we all gather in an earth circle and with speculums look up into our vaginas. I said, excuse me, I'm not very keen on looking at my privates the best of times, certainly not in a group of people. And she said, oh, the nuns, because I was brought up as a Roman Catholic, have made you ashamed of your body. There was an awful lot of nuttiness involved. And actually, Sally, I'm sorry about that, but I thought throwing flour at the Miss World thing was a bit loopy. You know, I just sort of thought, oh, forget it. But where I find the real feminists today are not in the West. I am so impressed by women from Africa, and particularly in the Middle East, who are working in very, or living in very Islamic conservative societies. The kind of risks they take. You, Sally, were arrested. Tough. But these people, I mean, they suffer fantastically from all of the oppression of patriarchy, which is backed by culture and religion. And we are so spoilt over here.
Sally, you were very serious about your protests. Was it a problem for you that by flower bombing you did earn the ridicule of the press, that it somehow became funny to be a feminist?
It was always funny to be a feminist, and I think that's important to say. I think there's something I'd like to say, which is that there wasn't one kind of political way of campaigning. I mean, there was campaigns for equal pay, women's centres, violence against women. The four campaigns of the women's movement were for equal pay and education, nurseries, free abortion and contraception on demand. You know, a movement operates at several different levels. There's a lot of competition about oppression, but I do think that probably every generation of young women needs to make a mark in some way and to come to terms with the difference that sexuality orders in their culture. So, you know, the Miss World bombing was one campaign among many.
Although those very spectacular things do...
They're the ones people remember. They don't want to talk about equal pay.
No.
I think you're... Can I say something? From a distance, all of the media coverage, although it was annoying and superficial when it happened, was good, because the women's movement in the United States and England was effective much more rapidly and much more thoroughly than anybody would have ever predicted. We live in media societies. In the United States, which is a huge country, the word about women's liberation spread from a couple of hundred women on the East Coast, of whom I was one, to the entire country. And this was done through media coverage. And it may have been that people were writing stories about blowing up silly events, but they were also making the women's liberation movement big news. And that meant that women all over the United States were learning about it and getting involved. And so I think that these were effective and necessary aspects of a large-scale movement.
It's very important to remember as well that these were times that were desperately unequal. Elaine, you've developed a whole feminist critique of literature, one which has, in fact, been given its own name, its own categorisation, gynocriticism. Did you think that, as an academic, there was prejudice against you because you were a woman?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When I moved to Princeton, where women faculty were relatively new and rare, there was open opposition and even harassment of a kind that now, very shortly after, people would be shocked and amazed. It was absolutely unbelievable that it would be tolerated. But it was very much the norm, and you were expected to kind of just turn the other cheek, ignore it, smile, just plug ahead. I think that was very typical. But what I think is much more important is to see what's been achieved. And I think it was achieved by a generation of activists who were willing to put up with the ridicule and put up with the pressure and put up with the harassment and press ahead and really did something of great historical importance.
And there were certainly campaigners from right across the board. Let's hear from a group now whose priority was certainly not semantics and abstracts, but simply the colour of society's money. We started with Obama and equal rights. So if we spool back 41 years, here are some women workers at the Ford factory in Britain who demanded equal pay.
When would, because, you know, the men would never have a clue how to even fiddle a needle, I shouldn't think, rather than do machining. And in the end, the women started talking amongst themselves and saying, well, this is not on. We can sort of turn our hands to anything, but the men can't.
Given their due, they did stand by us.
Even the postman. He said, what are you all doing out here? So we said, well, we've come out on strike. Right, oh, girls. And he turned around and went. So they never got their
list. Did they have any trouble with anybody?
We had the police from Dagenham Police Station come down every night to make sure we were all right.
Yeah, they used to look after
used to come down just to make sure we was right. You could say if you want, Pam.
They used to bring us a bottle of whiskey down
now and again to keep us warm.
Those were women from the Ford factory production line in Dagenham who went to court to argue that their pay packet should match that of equally skilled men. Sonia, you're a lawyer. Do you think that the fastest way to equality is through the law?
Well, I don't know what to say first because I'm sitting here feeling very frustrated and feeling like I'm coming across humorless when I'm usually known for my sense of humor. But it seems to me that much of this discussion has been frivolous, and no one listening to it would know that we revolutionized this country and the rest of the world is on its way also, or has already been revolutionized in the roles that women play. Nobody would know that from having listened to this conversation. That's what the women's movement is about. When it started in the 60s, there were defined roles for women in the United States. They were to be home, taking care of their husbands and raising their children. They were not hired in corporations for meaningful jobs. They did not have many roles as academics. They did not play important roles in our Congress, on and on and on and on. And we have changed all that, yes. The laws in this country played a tremendous role in getting change, but so did organizations like the National Organization for Women, the Feminist Majority, many, many other organizations. No one who was around in 1960 and can look at the country today would recognize the role of women. I was recently at the Yale Law School. 51% of the students there are women. The same is true in medical schools. Women are heads of universities. They are fire chiefs. They are police chiefs. It's unbelievable the revolution that has taken place.
Sally?
There's still a very big and important issue which hasn't been solved by however much there has been achievement in the at the level of professional women's employment. And that is the question of who looks after the children and how should they be looked after. And that was an issue that the women's movement raised and raises every time it emerges on the historical scene.
Sonia, you sound very proud of what you did. Is there anything that you would have done differently?
I don't really think about things like that, but I certainly agree with Sally. There is much left to be done. And here in the United States also, what we need is competent and affordable child care. Basically nothing has been done with that. I don't know why. I worked and raised my daughter, and it was a tremendously difficult proposition. And I was at that time in my 40s and a professional woman and had financial resources, and it was tough for me. This is a terrible problem, and no one's addressing it.
I'm sorry that Sonia thinks we're being frivolous, but perhaps, actually, although it was a revolutionary movement from which we all benefited, perhaps where the women's movement often went wrong was ignoring the ordinary feelings of ordinary women. And that's one of the reasons that you will hear women, even today, who have benefited from feminism and the movement will say, oh, I'm not a feminist. And it's not that they're scared of their husbands or anything, but the humorlessness, that puts them off.
I've never understood why it was understood as humorless. It was the best time. It was so much fun. It was filled with gorgeous, beautiful women. I don't understand it.
Well, I do, because I ploughed through a lot of feminist literature, and it was absolutely ghastly because it had no feeling for what real women, real human beings, feel about things.
Elaine, the women's movement has achieved a huge amount. Any regrets? Anything you'd have done differently?
No, I mean, I think that it was a great moment in history. I mean, I am enormously grateful that I was the right age to play a role in it, to be part of it, that it was my generation that was involved in it. This is a tremendous historical blessing to have been born into a period when great change is possible. It was a huge, human, funny, you know, excitable, serious, dedicated group of people who, I totally agree with Sonia, who changed this country beyond recognition, beyond expectation. And I think that's the way historians will regard us.
And a movement with great ambition, as one of the nuns who was on the original board of NOW said, it is simply about the possibility of realising one's humanity, of being human. Well, that's where we have to hold our female tongues today. But I leave you with bon mot from the poet, polemicist, historian and novelist Rebecca West. In 1910, West began her writing career as a columnist on the Suffragette Weekly, Free Woman. Years later, questioned about her take on the women's movement, she said, I myself have never been able to find out what feminism is. I only know that people call me a feminist whenever I express sentiments that differentiate me from a doormat or a prostitute. Rebecca West, a woman used, one suspects, to having the final word. Next week I'll be joined by four more women, Bea Campbell, Linda Bellos, Lynn Seagull and Ros Morris, as we discuss what it means in the decades of Margaret Thatcher, shoulder pads and lap dancers to call yourself a feminist. Join me then.